My name is Andy Conlin, and I'm a graduate student researcher with the Africa Center. Today, you're listening to Field Notes. Field Notes is a growing communications project designed to collect and promote research and communications from Colorado State University and beyond. Today, we're talking to Dr. Jessie Luna. She's an assistant professor of sociology and currently teaches classes on race and ethnicity and global environmental issues. Her research has investigated how cultural politics intersect with the forces of capitalism to produce and naturalize social inequalities and environmental degradation, with a focus on agrarian change in West Africa. In this segment, we talk about the links between environmental and social inequalities, adapting research questions to unforeseen circumstances, and how to be mindful of avoiding parachute science. Join us in welcoming Jessie.
My name is Jessie Luna. I'm an assistant professor in the sociology department. In terms of my research in Africa, I've done research in Burkina Faso in West Africa, primarily on questions of technology adoption in agriculture and the broader social, ecological changes that have gone along with various processes of technology adoption.
Can you give us a bit of background on what experiences led you to where you are today? And what kinds of research questions you're answering?
So I was when I was in my early 20s, I joined the Peace Corps. And I had had previous experience working in agriculture on research farms. And so I got assigned to be an agriculture volunteer. And I spoke French, so they sent me to West Africa. And I ended up working as a Peace Corps volunteer in a really small rural village in the country of Mali, which is landlocked country in West Africa. And I lived in this community for over 2 years and worked with farmers. And I was in many ways stunned by, I worked with cotton farmers. And cotton farmers grow cotton in a system where they have to take out really big debts at the beginning of the year, and then they have to repay their debts at the end of the year based on how much cotton they grow. And large numbers of farmers fall into debt every year, and they actually have to pay back the money or sell their material, like their objects, like motorcycles, in order to repay their debts. And I just became really, really interested in these questions of global inequality and a system where farmers were growing cotton that was getting exported to global textile companies, and they themselves were making almost no money, or they were falling into debt from this system. And in the process, they were also degrading their soils and polluting their rivers with various agricultural inputs. And so it was my experience in the Peace Corps that really got me interested in going back to academia, in asking questions about the history of colonialism, ideas about sustainable development, what it was exactly that I was doing there as a white person, and what does it mean to try to help farmers in these kind of complex histories. And so I went to graduate school for a program in interdisciplinary sustainable development. So I went to a program in Switzerland on and finished my program and basically still had all these questions and decided to go on for a PhD in sociology. And so I wanted to go back to West Africa to study agricultural change. And at that time, in the mid-2000s, there were very few genetically modified crops grown in Africa. I mean, there still are very few. And I was really interested in the introduction of genetically modified crops in West Africa. And so the country of Burkina Faso had introduced genetically modified cotton, and there were all of these really rosy stories that I was reading about how genetically modified cotton was going to help farmers out of poverty and increase yields. And what I was seeing was very, very few actual empirical studies evaluating it. And so that's where initially what I went to do for my research was to go study what exactly is going on with genetically modified cotton. And in particular, I wanted to understand farmer perspectives on the technology, how they were incorporating it into their farming systems, how it changed their farming, and understand also the institutional context in which it had been introduced, and whether there were conflicts, for example, between the state, the companies and farmers and their different sort of interests. And so that was essentially what I began my research with, was that question around this new agricultural technology and essentially trying to understand what changes it was bringing, but also how people were understanding it, why they were adopting it. And that was how I kind of began my research.
So I saw on your website there was a wrench thrown in your original plan to explore the genetically modified cotton growing there. So how did you adapt to these circumstances, and how did it shape the research that, or the ongoing research that you conducted after that?
Yeah.
That you plan to conduct in the future?
Yeah. So as many graduate and students know, and as many researchers know, we write these really big proposals and we get funding and we go off to do research. So I had a whole research plan shaped around studying genetically modified cotton and working with farmers and seeing how the technology was changing farming practices. I showed up in Burkina Faso a couple months before the beginning of the farming season in order to kind of get myself situated and figure out where I was going to do my research. And about 2 months after I got into Burkina Faso, into the course of my research, the state announced that they were terminating their contract with Monsanto and they would not be growing genetically modified cotton that year. It was done. So I was able to interview tons of people and actors, Monsanto employees and state employees, about the process of what happened and why that happened. But then I was suddenly in this situation where all of the rest of my research plan in terms of watching how farmers use the technology were suddenly no longer applicable. And it was actually a gift for me because it forced me to step back and ask what was the deeper and underlying question that I was interested in, and think about how genetically modified crops are simply one example of an agricultural technology. They get a lot more attention. Mm-hmm. People internationally debate them and there's anti-GMO movements. Mm-hmm. And yet there's all these other processes of change in agriculture in terms of adoption of agricultural technologies. Theoretically for me, in terms of the process of deepening relations of capitalist agricultural production that are also underway outside of just simply the case of genetically modified cotton. So for me, it was super useful in stepping back and thinking about, what I'm really interested in is these gradual processes of increased commodification of agriculture, increased embedding of farmers into a capitalist system of agricultural production, of purchasing inputs as opposed to producing their own inputs. So whether that's seed, whether that's fertilizer, buying tractors instead of using animal traction. So all of those kinds of ways in which farmers are increasingly relying upon purchased inputs that are coming from outside, how is that changing their agriculture? Why are they taking part in these processes? Mm-hmm. Why are some people gung-ho about it and other people resistant to it? What's going on there in terms of rural social dynamics, and in particular, processes of rural differentiation between wealthier farmers and poorer farmers. Mm-hmm. And so I was really interested fundamentally in those processes. And so being forced to move on from looking at GMO crops forced me to actually much better crystallize my underlying research interests. Mm-hmm. And then I began to pay attention to pesticides in particular. So I had not originally been planning to study pesticides. Mm-hmm. And when I began to do my work with farmers in rural areas, I was immediately struck by the dramatic increase in pesticide use in the area compared to when I'd been there roughly 10 years prior as a Peace Corps volunteer. And so I began to be much more interested in these questions of pesticide adoption and what was driving pesticide adoption, and then looking at like the evolution of labor shortages and how labor shortages were related to broader cultural shifts. And so I very much pay attention to culture, cultural meaning, understanding people's aspirations and status making, to think about the changes in farmer behavior, changes in sort of the rural social structure. Mm-hmm. And so looking at pesticides actually was in many ways much more interesting Then the question of GMO crops. I continued to ask farmers questions about what their experiences had been with GMO crops, and so I was still able to collect a fair amount of data on that. But it was a gift. Yeah, it opened me up to all of these new questions that have pushed me into a lot of new and what I think are really important directions.
I guess moving more towards the future then, so if that was kind of what your shift in research was, what's your kind of future direction that you plan to go?
Well, right now I'm working on writing a book based on my data from Burkina Faso, but also some of my ongoing. So I've had the chance to go back to Africa since collecting my data. I've had the chance to go back twice to share my research at two conferences, one in East Africa and one in West Africa, and talk to lots of African-based researchers on pesticide use in African agriculture. So one area that I want to continue to work on is on this question of pesticides in African agriculture. I think it gets a lot less attention from, in particular, from the West. It's oftentimes assumed that there's this expression, Africa is too poor to pollute. And at the same time, there's arguments that have been made that the pollution is a necessary price to pay for development. And so, like, there's a famous Lawrence Summers memo from a while back where he, you know, makes this argument that, yeah, you know, these under-polluted areas actually should have more pollution. So there's this real problem right now of exponentially increasing pesticide use in Africa that is actually receiving relatively little attention. It's receiving a lot of attention within Africa from locally based researchers, but they're oftentimes extraordinarily underfunded. So toxicology departments, they have very few resources, and regulatory systems that are in place right now in Africa are woefully inadequate. The studies, so I've been continuing to be involved in this area, and there are just study after study after study that has been done showing that farmers are using way more pesticides than any official documentation shows. So the import records of pesticides are falling short of what is being found when you go and interview farmers. Vast majorities of farmers now across Africa are using pesticides, not only in commercial agriculture, but also in small-scale family, small plots. They're using herbicides. Glyphosate is the number one used herbicide. But they're also using all kinds of products that are actually banned in Europe, products that have strict regulations on them in particular in the European Union, which has much stricter regulation than the U.S. on pesticides. So there's all these products that are coming in basically from China in particular, generic products that are coming in, some manufactured in China, some in India, that are coming in through the back door that are not being monitored and regulated. And farmers have very little idea what they are. They aren't using protective equipment. And so I honestly think there's like a crisis right now in terms of the health and environmental consequences of this sort of dramatic increase in pesticide use and in some cases really highly toxic pesticide use. Yeah. In the U.S. we often use these terms like wicked problems but it is extremely complicated. Yeah. In terms of figuring out how to address it, given the shortage of regulatory power, even countries that want to do more, they don't have the resources. So underfunded governments that don't have the resources to regulate, combined with farmers who are struggling to make ends meet, and they have their children who are going off to school, their kids want to move to the city and do anything but stay in farming. So there's this massive labor shortage. And so chemicals are desired by farmers. And so there's so many complex questions and trade-offs. And so that's certainly an area that I want to continue to do research in.
Yeah, I think it's the epitome of kind of the social scientist perspective of you have to handle ecological, social issues, and they're so interwoven. And it's a lot to try to wrap your head around, and it can feel really incredibly overwhelming too.
Yes, it's overwhelming. I just came back from a conference in Côte d'Ivoire, which was it was about 2 weeks ago, and it was a conference on pesticide politics in Africa. And it was a four-day conference, and pretty much the entire conference, everybody's contribution was to be, you know, we were pointing out these incredible dilemmas right. of this is not an easy problem to solve.
Yeah. I think that leads us well into another question being, for people who are new to social science, your research has all these social factors of economics and politics and culture, but then also these ecological environmental issues. Mm-hmm. And how do you, for the layman, mm-hmm. explain kind of the intersection of these two issues?
Mm, yeah. There's a number of ways that I think about it. At the broadest level, I think about it in the sense that environmental sciences help us understand the sort of physicality of environmental problems, right? Whether there's carbon dioxide levels are rising in the atmosphere, or whether there's, you know, nutrient leaching in a field. And these are incredibly important. But those sciences don't allow us to understand why these things are happening, why humans are doing what they're doing. Why do we continue to pollute, despite the fact that we have science showing us that carbon dioxide is warming? What are the underlying systems in terms of social arrangements, structures of society, so, and as you mentioned, economic systems, political systems, social systems of meaning and relationship that shape human behavior in these complex ways, so that despite knowing that there's a problem, we continue to engage in behavior that causes the problem. So I think social sciences have so much to offer in terms of helping us understand that what is it about human behavior and the way that we've organized human societies that are causing these environmental problems. So that's sort of the most basic first level. The other thing that I think social sciences do that is, for me, absolutely essential is helps us think about how environmental problems and environmental issues are not evenly distributed. They are not neutral. They are not sort of just like everybody experiences them in the same way. Nor does everybody think about them in the same way. So there's a dimension of social science that helps us understand how knowledge is produced, why some people think things are a problem mm-hmm. and other people don't. So there's an entire realm of social science that helps us understand why is there so much climate change denial in the United States? There's a realm of environmental sociology that has studied this for decades to try to understand how people make sense of the environment, how our knowledge about the environment is shaped. And in another vein, there's another realm where we look at inequality and in terms of the distribution of environmental harms, the distribution of environmental goods, and looking at the history of the production of these inequalities. So in my own research in Burkina Faso, for example, I've looked at how, you know, what is the difference between really, really poor and marginalized farmers versus really wealthy farmers who have tractors, and their difference in terms of their exposures to environmental degradation, in terms of the processes of differentiation in some cases, in terms of how inequality is actually getting worse. Mm-hmm. So thinking about these connections between environmental issues and environmental issues and social inequalities is, for me, essential. In some cases, it helps us understand even why environmental issues are being caused in the first place. It can actually be rooted in economic inequalities and social inequalities. But in other cases, it points us to how we overlook environmental problems when they're problems that are pushed onto other people who are marginalized peoples. So, right, the environmental justice movement in the United States has helped shed light on those environmental inequalities in the U.S., but they're global. So my own work has looked also a lot at environmental inequalities between the global north and Africa, and how, in many cases, there's a history of a production of sort of outsourcing resource extraction to the global south, exactly. And then in many cases also continuing to ship our waste back to those countries. So like we can think about our cell phones. We get our the raw materials from our cell phones from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, mm-hmm. and then we outsource our e-waste back to, for example, Ghana, and it goes to e-waste dumping sites. So,
yeah. So you're doing cross-cultural research abroad, and you kind of mentioned, what am I doing here mm-hmm. during the Peace Corps?
Yeah.
And what are some things in your research that you've been especially mindful of, and how have you worked to avoid parachute science?
Mm. It's a really important question. I've thought a lot about that. When I returned from the Peace Corps and I started my graduate work, I was immediately drawn to reading in the post-colonial scholarship. I have, over the years, also been drawn to understanding the sociology of race and the history of the production of racist ideology, which is embedded in colonial ideology. And all of these literatures deal with these questions of the ongoing power dynamics, and the power dynamics that arise also in research, where researchers, particularly white — I am white, I'm a middle-class white woman from the United States, and I come in suddenly, right, to do my research, to extract data, to come back, write my publications, and publish on them. And so even before I went to do my research, I was thinking carefully about those questions. And I still grapple with them. I think there isn't a way to say, oh, I've checked a couple boxes, or I write up a little positionality section in a paper, and then that's done. It's just something that I continue to grapple with. But the ways that I grapple with it, in terms of how I think, the ways that I address it, one is that I did long-term ethnographic research. I conducted data. I conducted my field work in the local language, so I speak the local language fluently. So this was not something that I was doing through a translator and then sort of hoping that I was understanding what was going on. Yeah. That I thought was really, really important. Not to say that that always has to be the case, but for me that was a level of showing my investment in the culture and the place of where I was doing my research, in ways that were oftentimes — this was so appreciated by people that I did my work with. So I conducted research in a community where I lived for 5 months in a rural area, and just about everybody I met there told me that they'd never ever met a white person who spoke their language, that they were able to sit down with and talk to and ask me about my life and ask me about what it was like in America, and, oh, I've heard this, is this true? And to get to spend that extended time in a community, not just sort of sitting down and doing a survey, mm-hmm. But spending hours with people. I mean, I spent months living in this community. I farmed with people. I went and I helped them plant their cotton. I helped them thin their cotton, weed their cotton, harvest their cotton, and spend extended amounts of time simply together as human beings, right? Like, not — I'm not interviewing you right now. And that way of building in respect for the people that I was working with, I thought was really critical. Mm-hmm. It's something that now that I'm a professor and I don't have 9 months to go collect my data, mm-hmm. and I have small children, and so I can't just go over there for like really, really long periods of time. Now I'm actually much more grappling with this question. What does it mean for me to be able to continue to do research in Africa in a way that doesn't then reproduce those kinds of dynamics that I don't want to produce? Mm-hmm. For me, it limits me in some ways, and I haven't yet really figured out how I might do that, and that's something I'm really struggling with.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
So I'll also add, the other thing that I've begun doing is co-authoring with Burkinabe authors, so Burkinabe sociologists that I've begun co-authoring with, and that for me is an important step in saying I'm not just going — I think there's ways which we oftentimes use collaborators as like, oh, you can be a research assistant, these kinds of things, but offering in some ways what is like the ultimate prestige that we have in academia is authorship. Mm-hmm. And so co-authoring with African authors for me has been another way to sort of — not only does it help me make sure that like the ideas that I'm producing are not reproducing sort of a Western white gaze, but I also feel like it's a way for me to offer like real collaborative production of knowledge, with people in the place that I'm doing research. Okay. So I've just co-authored with two different Burkinabe co-authors, and it's hard because they're Francophone, and I need to publish in English, and so that's been a real obstacle that's taken extra time on my part. One of my authors I actually had to translate everything into French for because he doesn't speak English. And that took a lot of extra work on my part, but I felt like was worth it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think it's also, you mentioned that you go back and you present your findings, and I think that's
yes.
also an important element of it, is rather than just getting your data and
leaving, yes.
is returning to share what you found.
Yes, exactly. I've gone back to two conferences that were primarily African researchers, one in East Africa and one in West Africa, and it was such a like amazing experience for me to get to go back and share my findings and really get really, really positive feedback as well from people.
Cool.
Yeah. One thing I will add, I think oftentimes, especially in critical graduate programs in the United States, there's so much reading on sort of not reproducing this, that it almost ends up in a point where I think there's this feeling like we shouldn't go to Africa and do research at all. We should just stay home. I will say, coming back from Cote d'Ivoire 2 weeks ago, people are like anxious and eager, and like they want help doing research that is so badly needed.
Mm-hmm.
They're lacking funding. They're lacking university training programs. So I would say that like that fear of reproducing the colonial and the racist and these power structures is one to always have in mind. And yet, I don't think it's a reason for us to simply stay home. African researchers I was with at this conference in Cote d'Ivoire, from across West Africa in particular, they were all saying, yes, we would love to work together. We would love to collaborate. They would love for me to help advise their graduate students. And so all of that is I think, kind of weighing this, like, how do we do this?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it means that it should be a justification to just stay home and not engage.
Yeah. What has been the most challenging and most rewarding aspects of your projects? And that can be anywhere from Peace Corps up until now.
I think the most challenging thing in the process of doing my dissertation research in Burkina Faso was, like, I'd taken all these methods classes on research design, on, all of the theoretical problem framing, the this, the that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the actual sort of logistics, I guess, and the what actually happens in the field isn't really discussed in methods classes. How you actually find your research site, for example. I remember spending like an entire month thinking, how am I going to find my research site? What rural town am I going to end up in? And how am I going to find it? How am I going to then justify it in terms of, I chose, that later on I'll write some lit review that's like, or my method sections, like, this village was chosen because of reasons X, Y, Z, right?
When in fact it was mostly just, there.
There were theoretical reasons, but there were also reasons like, there's currently an increased risk of kidnapping of white people. I should probably be in a place where I have really good cell phone coverage and I'm near a road, right? These like practical reasons that you then don't write up in your case and method section of like, this village was chosen because of its, proximity to a paved road, right? So the practicalities of research, and that was something. And I should add, I didn't have anybody on my dissertation committee who had worked in West Africa. So I didn't have anybody sort of paving the way for me in terms of like, here's my contacts, here's what I did. I was kind of on my own. And so I had to figure it out. And that was hard.
Mm-hmm.
That was really hard. In terms of most rewarding, I would say, honestly, some of the most rewarding was coming back and giving my research. Giving my presentations of research at these conferences in Africa. I remember a Burkinabe toxicologist. So he has a PhD. He's a professor of toxicology. He studies pesticides in Burkina Faso. I remember him coming up to me after I presented my research that was very much like cultural change and sociology and all of this. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, what you presented it was like you knew my soul better than I know it myself. And he basically said, you know, you just described exactly what's going on in our country in a way that, like, put a finger on it better than I could have even crystallized it. And so he was just like, oh, my God, you've got to send me your paper. This is just, like, amazing. And that was, for me, it was so, that was rewarding to know, in some ways, to know that I you know, that was a verification in some sense of, like, what I'm writing about is, resonates with people in Burkina Faso. But the other thing I would say is also just the relationships and friendships of people that I worked with. And, you know, I still get phone calls multiple times a week from people in West Africa. And they call me when somebody's gotten married or there's a new child who's been born. And I've gotten to call them back and tell them about the birth of my children. And so just the maintenance of those relationships is also, I think, the most rewarding.
Really special.
Yeah.
For sure.
For my last question, I'm wondering, what is one piece of advice that you would give to a graduate student or early career academic?
I think the one piece of advice I'd give is to focus on what it is that you want to get out of graduate school. So often I think we end up in a pattern of jumping through the hoops that are right in front of us. Okay, I need to pass this class. I need to write this term paper. I need to pass my comps. I need to do this. And we get caught up in the little micro steps that we need to do. Or we get caught up in the interests and directions of our advisors. And we sometimes can lose sight of what it is that I'm here to do. What is it that I want to get out of graduate school? Where do I want to go after graduate school? What kind of career do I want? And what are the questions that interest me? And so finding that space to sort of carve out and make time to remind yourself of your own objectives and how to thread through the hoops that you need to get through, but to not let them shape where you end up. If they lead in a direction that's different than the one that you want to go in, or to not let them get you so bogged down that you lose sight of it, of where it is that you want.
If you are a new listener, feel free to connect with the Africa Center by visiting africacenter.kalostate.edu. And the tab at the top that says connect will allow you to join our email list where you can receive newsletters as well as information about upcoming events. We look forward to seeing you next time, and thank you for listening to Field Notes.